All right, well, I thought what we would do is do a little Q&A with David here this evening so you can get to know him a little better. And then tomorrow what we'll do is we'll have a Q&A time where you can ask questions of him that maybe have to do with some of the different talks that you've heard this weekend or other things that are on your mind. But this evening, really just an opportunity to get to know him a little better and pick your brain a little bit, David. So do this for us. Give us your story growing up. So you grew up, you said, in South Texas. So you grew up where? What was your family like growing up? And give us that history.
Sure. So I was born in Glasgow, Scotland, and raised in a Christian home. Both my parents were converted to Christ in the Baptist church, so we were raised Baptists until I was about 11 or 12. And I'm not quite sure yet what went wrong in the church, but my father didn't know a lot of theology at the time, but he thought there was something going on. I think it was maybe a sort of dispensational thing or something like that. But anyway, he decided to take us out of that, and he was a dentist, and one of his patients was a Presbyterian pastor. So he persuaded him to bring his family to the Presbyterian church. And it was a very strict, conservative Presbyterian church, and it was actually a real whiplash for us kids. So, like, you're a young teenager, you've been used to a very happy, bright, friendly, short sermons, enjoyable, kind of generally bright, happy atmosphere. And we were taken to this church, and it was like literally dark. It was dark wood, it was dark lights, it was the sermons were about 3 times longer, the prayers were about 5 times longer. The whole culture was different. There was a lot of the Sunday schools, no more candy. It was all, memorizing catechisms and things like that. And I'm sure a lot of it was, well-intentioned and good and helpful. But, like, for me, the contrast was really painful, and it didn't help me spiritually. And through my teenage years, I was increasingly rebelling against all that my parents had taught me, all that I'd been taught at church, and I was going to public school. There were no such things as Christian schools or homeschool in Scotland, and it was really just going from bad to worse through my teen years, and I was a disaster of a student. I just wanted to play soccer and party and make money. That was my growing up, I'm afraid. Not very proud of that.
And so, how did you come to know Christ then?
So I left school a year early, and I just wanted to work and make money. And I eventually wanted to own my own business, but I thought I better learn a bit first of all. And so I went to work with an insurance company, life insurance, investments, pensions. And it was the 80s when Margaret Thatcher, Ronald Reagan era. It was very prosperous, I think, here as well. And it was very easy to make a lot of money if you worked hard. And I had really good bosses, and they gave me lots of opportunities, and I took them. I was working, 18-hour days, and really just striving, striving, striving to get on, and partying at the weekend. Eventually moved out of my mom and dad's house so I could have freedom, and got my own place. And hoping this would be sort of the life for me. This would just be, what every young guy dreams of. And yet, I was not happy. No matter how many Friday nights I went out for, no matter how much I earned, no matter what position I attained, it was never enough. It was just like, I need more. I want more. Give me more. And I can look back and say the Lord was looking after me in these days, even though I was an unbeliever and very rebellious. I was still going to church, but totally uninterested, not listening at all. And just living for the weekends, living for vacations, and I'd find myself outside clubs on a Friday night, and I was like sitting on the steps outside, and I'd be crying. I didn't know why. Like, my friends would be coming out going, "What is wrong with you?" And I didn't actually know. I just couldn't stop crying. I'd go home and I'd kind of resolve, okay, never again, and I'm going to change. I never did. But God brought a few things into my life. A colleague of mine who was only 33, so just over 10 years older than I was at that time, he died of cancer right in front of me, really. He was over a series of weeks, he was getting treatments, and he was just withering in front of my eyes. Went to his funeral. It was the first funeral of anyone I'd known, really, and it really struck me how final it was. And he was an unbeliever, too. And then I was at a big company launch of a new product in Gleneagles Hotel in Scotland, and we had the Scottish soccer team was staying there at the time. Like, for a young guy mad in soccer, you felt, you know, this is, you know, I should really be one of you guys, you know, but, you know, this is good enough. And it's like the Dallas Cowboys or something to you people, I think.
Chicago Bears.
Yeah.
Chicago Bears.
Okay, yeah. Chicago Bears, okay. I better not say Michigan anyway. On the way back from that, one of my bosses hit a car from behind. It was driven by a young mother, and her six-month-old baby was catapulted out the window and died. And I didn't know about that till the next day. I went into work, and everything was just like stony silence. Found out what happened, and it just struck me, like, that could have been you, David. And he went to prison for a long time for manslaughter. He was a top executive. So I suppose the Lord was just showing me the ugliness of my life, the destructive nature of it, the selfish nature of it, the unhappiness of it. And yet I still wasn't, I didn't feel I was turning to the Lord. I could, looking back, I know he was calling me, but I wasn't answering. No matter how deep my misery was. One day I went home and I spoke to my dad and I said, he could tell I was miserable. He said, "What's up?" And so I explained a few things. He said, "Well, David, have you ever thought maybe the Lord is hunting you down and he's converting you?" And I could honestly say I hadn't thought that once, but as soon as he said it, I knew. That was nothing else could explain this, because he was making me hate the things I used to love. And and maybe beginning, I could see a sense of a beginning of, like, God's people, Christians, were beginning to be tolerable, barely. But my mother gave me a little Bible study, and I hadn't read my Bible or prayed for years. And so I started reading my Bible, and I would say over about a two-month period, just Jesus came out of the pages of the Bible. Not physically, obviously, but it was like he was as real as you are, Jason, to me. It was just, there was no question, this was not a book about a dead person. This was a living reality who was grabbing me, and gently, but enough to pull me out of the pit I was in and pull me to himself. And over these months, it's just like he became more and more vivid, clear, wonderful, lovely, compelling, irresistible. It was like, it wasn't like I decided for Christ or anything like that, but he decided for me. And it was irresistible grace. And eventually, after a couple of months of that, realized I couldn't continue in my job because it involved a lot of social, like drinking and even kind of low-level corruption, I would say. I didn't know what lay ahead for me, but I just knew I had to get out of that. I knew I just had to cut the ties. I knew I couldn't survive there spiritually. So I was due to give my boss my a six-monthly report, and I went in with my letter of resignation, and he was really mad. Obviously, they train you, and they have, you know, they organize their company, and they, you know, they're going to put you here, there, and I'd just blown his plans out of the water. And I said, look, I'll work my notice. I'll do a month, whatever is required. And he said, you will leave today. And he said, give me the car keys, because it was a car the company had given me. Your mortgage ends today, because I had a cheap mortgage from financed by the company. And that was it. Like, I walked out of the office, went to the streets of Glasgow, and I thought, I have no job, I have no car, I have no house. But I think I was the happiest man in Glasgow. because it was like that 11:28, it was free. I was at rest, and it was peaceful for like the first time ever. I didn't know what lay ahead, but whatever lay ahead was better than what was behind.
Yes. But truth be told, happiest man in Glasgow is not saying much. I have a lot of good Scottish friends.
Yeah, right? It's not.
Yeah. That's excellent, Dave. So you come to Christ, and you started going then to back to the church that your parents were?
Yeah. And it wasn't an easy church to go to at the time. I don't want to say too much, but it wasn't easy to understand the pastor. Let me just leave it at that. My friend, a person who'd become a friend, a young Christian man, sort of took me under his wings. He'd just started a business, and he said, why don't you come and be a driver for me, just deliver stuff to customers. He said, I can't pay you much. Like basically cover your travel, but we'd have lots of time together because he wasn't very busy. So I thought that sounded great to me. And he'd been a Christian for a number of years, and he just started feeding me Banner of Truth books, sermons by Pastor Al Martin, Sinclair Ferguson, various Americans actually, some Southern Baptists. I was just like water, you know, for a thirsty soul. I was listening to about six sermons a day. I was driving around the car all on cassette tape, and I could imitate Al Martin just perfectly by the end of it. We were memorizing scripture. It was just like a cram course in Christianity, and that went on for, so that was sort of making up for what I wasn't getting in church. And I was unsettled there. I didn't know what lay ahead, and had a chance to go to Eastern Europe for a year and work with, the Iron Curtain was just coming down there in the late 80s, and it was really to do a bit of teaching of English as a foreign language, helping out in church building sites, helping Romanian refugees who were coming over from the persecution, and just anything that people wanted me to do. I just wanted to be a pair of hands and legs, and I met real Christians, like as real as you could imagine. You know, people had been through a lot of persecution, suffered, lost their liberty, some of them. And that was like totally compelling to me. It just gripped me, their passion, their purpose, their sacrifice, their willingness to give everything for the Lord. And I think it was there really I felt that very strong call to the ministry, that, you know, whatever kind of ministry, I didn't know. I was quite keen on just going straight off, like, you know, I was reading that story about John Chow this week. Yeah. And I could see some of myself in him. I just wanted to get out there, and thankfully, I had an older man in my life who sort of, again, took me under his wings, and he said, you know, David, you should really get a bit of training and, you know, learn some stuff, maybe, like, before you become a teacher. And you don't like to hear that, you know, but when I was in Hungary, I realized that I needed to go back to school. And So when I came back from there, I enrolled in Glasgow University, did 3 years there, then did my Master's of Divinity, which was another 3 years, so it was a 6 year. Yeah, it was a long trial.
Yes. And then you were ordained in the...
This was the Free Church of Scotland.
Yes.
Scottish Presbyterian, smallish, maybe 120 churches throughout Scotland, some mission interests, had a great history, but like all the churches in Scotland, I should say most of them, very much in decline, numerically, spiritually too, but some lovely Christians, and I pastored two churches in Scotland, one for 4.5 years, one for 7 years, in the Northwest Highlands, and I loved it very much.
Yes. And describe the Highlands for people here that maybe have not seen the Highlands or heard of the Highlands. Unique part of the world. So describe the Highlands.
Yeah, it's a beautiful part of the world to live, even for all the rain and cold and wind. We loved it. And there's a lovely spirituality there amongst the remaining Christians. They're very serious about their faith and very exercised Christians, prayerful. There's a real joy to pastor there. So yeah, very mountainous, very sparsely populated. Probably the village I pastored in first had a population of about 400, 500. Then I went to Stornoway in the Isle of Lewis, which had a population of maybe about 15, 18,000. And great place to raise family, great place to fish.
To raise sheep. Yes.
Lots of sheep,
yes.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Cloudy, rainy.
Cloudy,
beautiful.
Rainy, yeah.
Yeah. So what brought you to the United States?
So yeah, I should say I acquired a wife along the way here.
Yeah, that's probably good. Yeah.
In my first year in Glasgow University, she was studying medicine, and we literally bumped into one another. We were actually going to the same church, but she'd been a Christian for many years, and I'd been a rebel for many years. I wouldn't look at her, she wouldn't look at me, I hope. But when I was converted, I saw her in a different light. And she gave me a chance to prove that I had seen the light. And the Lord has blessed me with just a wonderful, lovely, godly wife. Yeah.
You guys have been married how long?
28 years.
You and Shona have how many children?
Five.
Five children, yep. And their ages?
22, 21, two boys, 16, 15, two girls, and a five-year-old boy.
It's a busy house. And you have one that's getting married very soon.
Yep. He's in the U.S. Marines, in the reserves at the moment, and has his own painting business now. So.
Good. All right, can we journey across the waters
now?
Okay, so what brought you to the United States?
Well, when I was pastoring in my last church, we started a little seminary. It was a distance learning seminary to try and train. We couldn't afford building profs and all that. We couldn't afford that. But various men were asked to try and put together courses to train our own handful of students, meet with them a couple of days a month in Inverness. And I'd been asked to do the Hebrew, because at least I knew the alphabet. And so I taught Hebrew and Old Testament and learned a lot. And in the course of doing that, I got a lot of resources from U.S. seminaries like RTS, Westminster, PRTS, Puritan, and Grand Rapids. I just sent letters to everyone. It was pre-email days. And they were so generous with resources. People sent me full courses and notes. It was just amazing. So I got to know some people that way, got to know Joel Beakey. I asked him to come over to a conference. He couldn't come, but his colleague Jerry Bilkis came. We got on like brothers. Then Joel came the next year. We got on really well. And then he called me in the August of 2006, totally out of the blue, and asked me if I would consider letting my name go forward to be a professor at Puritan Seminary. And my instinctive reaction was no, because I just loved my church. I loved where we lived. My wife had been through depression around the birth of our fourth child, and she was really just coming out of that after a number of years of suffering. So that's like a big factor. But I said the spiritual thing. I said, well, I'll pray about it. And so a couple of weeks later, I called him back and I said, no. I said, I don't believe it's the Lord's will. And he said, well, if you ever change your mind, you'll put it to the back of your mind, but if the Lord ever lays it on your heart, just, you know, let us know. So I worked really hard to forget this, like totally eliminate it. But it kept coming back very powerfully, and I couldn't escape it. Sometimes I didn't tell anyone. Like, I didn't even tell my parents. I told my wife, but I didn't tell my parents. And I'd be preaching to my congregation, and this was like in my mind, like, you know, I could be away from here, and this is just terrible. But no matter how hard I worked, I couldn't get it out of my head. My father had taught me a guidance principle: stay where you are unless the Lord shows you clearly otherwise. So that was sort of my principle, and I felt he hadn't shown me clearly otherwise, although I felt these tugs, but I couldn't be sure what it was. Like, my wife would, you know, prick me at times. She would, is it ambition? Is it ego? Is it pride? Is it desire for a change? You know, that's a good wife, right? Just getting you to test your motives and why are you thinking about this? Is it rightly motivated? And so that was a long struggle. But after about 7 months, I was talking to a minister friend who had taken a call to Australia, and I asked him, how did you figure that out? Like, I didn't tell him why I was asking, but I said, how did you figure out God was calling you to Australia? And he said, Dave, dead easy, multiply influence. I'm like, okay, where do you get that in the Bible? And he said, parable of the talents. I thought that was interesting because one of the things Joel Beakey had said to me was, David, it's wonderful. You've got a fairly large congregation there of a few hundred people, but, you know, imagine training pastors to go and themselves preach in congregations of a few hundred or whatever. So that kind of seemed to confirm what he said. So I went home, I got the parable of the talents, I came to the one talent man, and the one talent man said to the master, I played safe. I kept what you gave me. Here, have it back. And the master says, I wanted interest. I wanted you to invest. I wanted you to take a chance on this and take away what he has and give it to someone else. And I immediately felt it was the word of the Lord to me that I was that one talent man and I was playing safe. Like, I really like my church. I like my family here, my wife's health. You know, just don't rock the boat, status quo. Don't change anything. Just like, if we can just keep this going, this would be really good. And I felt the Lord was saying, David, if you disobey me, I can take away what you think is yours and secure and guaranteed. And I couldn't deny that was my thinking. And I went in to see my wife, and I said, Shona, I think the Lord is calling us to America. And she said, David, you know I will go wherever God calls you, but you better get it right.
That's also a good wife.
That's another good wife. Yes. So I called Joel Beakey and I said, look, I know this is like 8 months down the road. This might sound really crazy, but you told me to call you if there was any change of heart. The Lord had moved. And I told him, he said, well, that's amazing. He said, when I asked you these many months ago, there were 5 names that we were thinking of, and you're the only one left. That's kind of been the story of my life. Last man standing. But, you know, in other ways, it's kind of a confirmation too. You know, it felt, okay, so that looks again as if God's been working on 2 sides of the Atlantic. And it all went through incredibly quickly and smoothly. All the visas came through very quickly. And I had to tell my congregation. That was tough because I loved them so much. And You can't explain everything to everyone. You know, somebody once said, when you leave a congregation, some will be glad, some will be mad, and some will be sad. I had all three. And it's not easy. People you love and people you want to have their love, they don't understand, what's this guy going over to America for? They've got lots of preachers and pastors, and we're so... And I can't explain everything to everyone. It's an act of faith. And interestingly, just as to finish this up, what I most feared was Shona's health. You know, like, this is a huge transition. But actually, again, it just shows how the Lord will honor those who honor him. Her health has never been better since we came over here. Partly it's because she has less roles, so she wasn't practicing medicine anymore. She was in a community. We were homeschooling then. Like, we were total weirdos. There was no one else, hardly anyone else. And then you come over here and there's a big community of homeschoolers. That was like really encouraging for her. She wasn't a pastor's wife anymore, professor's wife, which is much easier. And it is much sunnier in Michigan, believe it or not. People find this hard to believe, really. But you actually have summers, right? We just had warmer rain in Scotland. And in the winter, like, there was only daylight, if you can even call it that, from 10 in the morning till 3 in the afternoon. And it's just gray and dark. You actually see blue sky, I don't know, every third day, fourth day? That's like Bermuda compared to Scotland. And you can do things here, like you can ski and you can, you can't do anything in the rain. So all of these things combined, especially the weather thing, we've just loved the seasons over here. The Lord has just used it all to really rebuild her and renew her, and yeah, it's been a blessing.
So let me ask about that. You and Shona freely talk about this. You've written a lot about depression. Tell us, if you were to give advice, you and Shona, to someone that's struggling with depression, what is some of the beginning advice that you give? And then also for someone that is caring for somebody, that is married to someone that is wrestling with depression, or has a child that is wrestling with depression, what is your advice to someone living in a relationship like that?
Yep. So Shona has written on this. Her book is called Refresh, Grace Paced Life in a World of Overwhelming Demands. So you can read her story there and all the things that helped her. There's many things. It's not one thing. I have found depression in Shona and in many others we have counseled since then to be a very complex problem that defies simple solutions. There's a school of thought that takes an all-spiritual approach. You just need more faith, more Bible, more prayer. There's a school that says you just need more medicine, things like that, so it's an all-physical approach. And others say you just need more counseling, work with the mind, cognitive work. I believe you need to approach this from every perspective. And God has made us so that our emotions, our bodies, our minds, they're all intertwined. You can't easily separate our soul, our heart, our body, our mind. Our genetics, our social experience, all of these things combine to make us who we are. And in depression, it's very rare that you just find one thing. Sometimes you do. You think of King David, who fell into depression. That was sin, right? It was very clear. You'd read symptoms of depression in Psalm 32, Psalm 51, and he traces it to his sin. There's a woman I knew very recently. She plunged into a depression during the beginning of the menopause. And this went on for months. She eventually went to the doctor. She got a blood test, and her hemoglobin, her blood count, was half of what it should have been, which impacts the liver, which impacts all the production of chemicals that produce emotions. She got on iron tablets, and within 3 weeks, her depression had lifted. So that's like a totally physical problem there. And King David's case, a totally spiritual problem. So there are rare cases where it's, you know, it is on the extremes, but I found in most cases it's a mix. And so you've got to look at the physical side of a person. You know, their rest, their sleep, are they taking a day off? Are they exercising, their diet? You have to look at their spiritual life. You have to look at their family life, their social history, their experiences that they've been through, any big life events. You have to look at the kind of thought patterns they're having. What is it, very negative, pessimistic, obsessive? Are they engaging in behavior which, you know, has to be looked at? So it's a complex thing, and therefore you can't manage it yourself. And indeed, I don't think any one person can help. I think you need a team. And so the first step is reaching out to a pastor, to a counselor, to a doctor, to a friend, somebody that you just begin to talk to. That is like the biggest step in depression, especially for men, like to actually start talking, to start sharing. Once you go over that, you begin to be honest and truthful, you are well on the way to recovery. But I would encourage you to look at the spiritual side of things. Have a doctor look at the physical, medical side of things. Maybe if it's lingering, you might need more specialist counseling on the more cognitive side of things. So, talk, get help, reach out, trustworthy people, take a multi-dimensional, a holistic approach to it, and be hopeful. You know, what I have found is every single person, I shouldn't say that as one person, it didn't, but every single person I've been involved with in counseling who has used all the means that God has provided physically, spiritually, socially, ecclesiastically, counseling-wise, they get better. They do get better. They might never get back to exactly where they want to be, but they will get back to sufficient level of mental, emotional, spiritual health. So I think to have that hope, to use the means, and get a good team around you.
And it takes a toll on those that are living with someone suffering from depression. So what would be some advice you'd give to a spouse or a parent?
I was a terrible, terrible helper to my wife initially, I'm afraid. I didn't understand depression. We weren't taught about it in seminary. I'd taken the view that Christians don't get depressed. If they do, you're either not a Christian or you're in a terrible sin. I knew my wife was more godly than I was. I knew she wasn't in sin, so I couldn't figure this out. I would say to her, look, you've got you're in a lovely congregation, we're in a lovely home, we've got lovely kids, we've got family around us, above all, you're married to me. I mean, what else? And she would say, all these things are true, but I can't stop crying. And I can't stop this panic. It's not a choice. It's not something that is controlled by logic or reason. So, it was only when we got her father involved, who'd been a very experienced pastor for over 50 years, had dealt with a lot of depression in the Western Isles. It's a terrible place for mental health issues. And he helped us to see, look, in his view, this was a physical problem caused by physical exhaustion, years of stress and strain, many factors in that, including a church split, friends' marriages broken up, pregnancies one after another, homeschooling, all of that. But it was a physical problem that had spiritual consequences. So you don't fix that by fixing the consequences. That's where I was focused. That's where she was focused. Even though she was a doctor, and had helped many people with depression, she couldn't see it in herself. So that immediately changed the way that we approached it. And for me, it was a process of learning. I began to read more widely, try and just take the place of a student, listen to more experienced men. And so that's what I would actually really encourage you to do, to start reading. There's multiple great books now from a Christian perspective on depression, and lots of good stuff online. So I think the best way you can help is to be educated, and to be patient and to listen without jumping in with solutions. That may come down the road, probably not from you, probably from people who know better, but just listen. That is amazingly therapeutic for someone with depression.
Good. All right, we switch it up. Rapid fire. You ready?
Okay.
Okay. Your favorite place to visit?
Israel.
Your favorite recreation?
Soccer.
I thought it was fishing.
Well, you know, if I'm honest, I'm not playing a lot of soccer these days. I'm like 52, so I think these days are gone. So fishing, secondly.
But I do love that you call it soccer and not football. All right. Scottish Highlands or Edinburgh?
Scottish Highlands.
Yeah. You have a free evening to read. Besides the Bible, what do you pick for your soul?
For my soul?
For your soul. Something
okay.
Stirs your soul.
Biographies. I mean, a lot of my work is reading thick books and dense books, so I like biographies. But if I'm honest, in the evenings, I'm usually, to keep reading Christian books is a struggle for me. I don't find it so refreshing when I've been doing it all day. So I listen to audiobooks of American presidents.
Love it. What's your favorite audiobook on American presidents?
My most recent one is the one on Truman, the Accidental President.
I just downloaded
that.
Did you?
Okay.
Yeah, okay. All right. Three theologians who have most shaped you.
Sinclair Ferguson, John Piper. Third one. Maybe a Puritan, John Flavel.
Yep, yep. How many days a week do you wear a kilt?
Does it look like I have the legs for a kilt? It'd be a mini skirt on me, you know?
When you got married, did you wear a kilt?
No. I mean, really? Seriously?
I'm just asking. We thought every Scottish person wore a kilt when they got married.
Since I've come to America, I've put on 24 pounds, right?
Good.
And
night.
Look at me now. I mean, I'm still beanpole. So,
yeah.
No, kilts were made for stocky Scotsmen.
Right.
Not beanpoles.
Okay, so help us with this haggis. What in the world is that?
Okay, so that's a little creature that has long legs on one side and short legs on the other side. To help them run round mountains,
yeah,
right,
uh-huh.
And like escape the butchers who chase them down.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, that's the haggis.
Really?
No. Haggis is made out of a sheep's stomach, and it has a sheep's innards inside of it. And only Americans eat it.
What about blood pudding?
See, yeah, my wife will eat that. I can't stomach it.
Oh, no. Yeah. Don't understand that.
I know.
Okay. Here we go. First car you owned?
A Ford Fiesta.
Really?
Yeah.
That's a little jobber.
Yeah.
Soccer or baseball? If you have to watch a game.
Soccer, yeah.
Yeah. And, David, as you think about the Scottish Kirk, the Scottish Church, think about the history of Scotland and the incredible Christian influence in Scotland, and now how Scotland is destitute,
yeah,
of a Christian influence. America, we often see, follows Western Europe, and seems like we're on a pretty dire trajectory at this point. What would be some of the advice you would have, or some of the encouragements you would have for the American church as we embark upon what appears to be a similar trajectory? No.
Yeah, the Scottish decline has been over about 150 years. It's accelerated in the last 50. And most people in Scotland will trace it to the churches handing the schools over to the state. So the churches started schools, and the state came in and said, look, we will give you the money to fund more education of poor people, and we'll keep religion in the schools. Well, of course, that didn't last very long, and it's just gone from bad to worse. My own education was horrific in every way, and it's only got worse. And yet, there are only probably about 3 Christian schools in the whole of Scotland, and they only have like 15 and 20 kids in them. There's very little homeschooling. There's more homeschooling going on, but still very little. Christian parents like just did not take that responsibility on. And now, when you look at our churches, there's like this vast generational gap. Like, there's lots of old people, and then there are less young couples, young families. And what you see is the kids coming up, and by the time they get to about 12, 13, 14, they're gone, because the majority influence upon them is hostile secular culture in the schools. And so, you know, one thing you want to really focus on here is that Christian education piece as much as you can. I just everyone over there sees that was the missing piece. And now there's very little to work with. There are the few families remaining. Some of them are really trying hard, but to actually rebuild from such a small base is going to be extremely hard. And it really needs a revival, a widespread revival. So in that sense, I think America's got a big advantage, because while your culture is going down, the church is still a big church. There's still a large number of Christians, not a majority, but a large minority. You still win some battles from time to time. We've not won a battle in Scotland for like 40 years. So I think your culture is very close to ours, but you still have this very large block of at least moral Christianity. I know a lot of it's shallow and superficial, but it still counts for something in terms of holding the culture back, I think.
And as you're training pastors and sending pastors into this culture and world, what is it that you're especially trying to drill into their mind and their heart as they're going out to pastor and minister?
Yep. I think what we're trying to do, at least at Puritan Seminary, is be translators and modernizers of confessional truth. So we're looking back all the time, you know, to our heritage, to established, proven, confessional truths, ecclesiology, doctrine, practice. But you can't just repeat that in today's culture. You've got to put it into language, concepts, ideas that connect with today's minds and problems and practices. So that's what we try to train our students to do, to be looking backwards, but trying to do this translation work so they don't just become, you know, 17th century voices in the 21st century. But neither are they 21st century voices with no foundation and background and heritage. So I think that's what we're trying to do, and really work at getting doctrine down to the day-to-day level of people's lives. There's a lot of doctrinal preaching that is kind of it's going over heads, or it's filling heads, but it's not moving the heart, it's not changing lives. And so I think there's a real need to get down to real detailed practical application of Scripture so that it's changing and it's transformative.
Love it. Let's end with this. The Puritans were masters of this. And probably in a room like this, my guess would be a majority of people have not read a single Puritan, and they feel very intimidating to think about reading a Puritan. We've heard horror stories about them. So, but the Puritans were masters of this. If you were to encourage people here to read some of the Puritans, where would they start, and what are some works or people that would be accessible and you think would be beneficial?
Yeah, so publishers have done some really good work here. The Banner of Truth have been publishing Puritan paperbacks for many years, and Reformation Heritage Books in Grand Rapids, it's connected with the seminary, they've been publishing summaries and simplified versions of Puritan works for many years. So, you know, get in contact with any bookshop, get in touch with RHB, and they've got catalogs of this, and it's very accessible, it's very digestible. The language has been updated, the presentation has been greatly improved. And so in terms of authors, I think you want to start with people like Thomas Watson, John Flavel, Jeremiah Burroughs. To me, these are like the most accessible Puritans, and take the least work to get the most benefit out of. I'd probably put John Bunyan in there as well, but probably his popular works, some of the others, get into very detailed, puritanical kind of mode. But actually, most of the Puritans have one or two works that are more at the popular accessible level, and that's what the publishers have tried to do. They've tried to pick out these ones, and what you'll find, I think, is there'll be a bridge for you. It'll sort of whet your appetite. You'll be surprised at how easy it is to understand and how helpful it is to your soul and your life. And yeah, I think it'll give you a momentum and a desire to read more, and to really, it'll deepen your spirituality, and above all, I believe it will deepen your love for Christ. They're very Christ-centered writers.
Absolutely. So as you think about this weekend, what do you hope we walk away with tomorrow? What is it that would say, oh, if they walk away with this, I'm happy?
I suppose I would love to see Christians more at peace. I feel we're very harassed and anxious and stressed and harried. And it's almost impossible. I'm not saying it's impossible. It's almost impossible to have spirituality in the midst of a hurricane like that. You know, we need to create space, time, quiet. We need that rest. Tonight we talked about spiritual rest. Tomorrow, physical and emotional rest. I think it's in these moments that we will really begin to know God. Be still and know that I am God. That's what I would love for myself more, what I would love for my family more, and yeah, the majority of Christians I'm working amongst are putting themselves under. We're not all victims in this. We are choosers. We are putting ourselves under incredible pressure in the pace of life. And I think a lot of us are pretty miserable in it. And I think there's another way. And I would love to be a means of that reset.
Good. Well, I hope you have a good night's rest.